One of the things I think that people don't really understand about PGA Tour players is about just how good they are, is they show up on different grass, different everything, every single week, and just play good.
This is The Tournament Code.
Thank you for joining us today, Scott. We've talked to you before, and we thought it'd be fun to have you back on, specifically talk about what you've been doing with your own playing career. We talk a lot about strategy with you. We had a fun conversation about lots of things, including Tiger, meditation, etc. And there's lots of people who can talk about things in theory. There's lots of historians who can talk about history of things. It's a lot harder and a lot more telling when someone can study history, study things of that nature, and then go put it into practice for themselves. And so
I don't study history.
Well, you study golf, you study strategy, and there's lots of theoretical strategists. There's lots of Monday morning quarterbacks, but there's one thing between saying this guy made a strategy mistake and then going out and actually putting yourself in a position to make strategy mistakes. It's one thing to say you got to work on speed, on putting almost more so than almost any other component, and then go out there and put yourself in a position where your speed is challenged, where three putts are open. So,
well, you know, it's funny, when I entered Champions Tour Q School last year, the amount of instructors that sent me messages and whatnot saying, man, it's really impressive that you actually go out there and play. And I guess I don't really think of it that way. I think of myself as a player, I'm not an instructor. I don't teach mechanics. I obviously teach strategy, but I definitely am a player, not anything else. And this is just side gig to that.
Yeah. And it's just, I get that. But for people listening, most people didn't know, obviously didn't know you when you were playing as an amateur or a pro, and know you from your strategy stuff. And I mean, you wouldn't call yourself a teacher, but in some ways you've changed a lot of people's golfing trajectories, including guys who are on tour now or who choose to work with you for some sort of strategy component and understanding decade better. So
actually, it's a combination point. I would consider myself a teacher. I would not consider myself an instructor. And maybe that's just purely semantics. I teach strategy. I think of as an instructor, someone who teaches the mechanical side of the game. So I've never really thought of it that way, but that's definitely how I would view it.
That seems like a fair delineation. Before we get going, quickly, we're going to do our Putt View Books opening tee shot. They sponsor us, help us keep the lights on, which is a really nice thing for us because I like our lights on and lets us have fun conversations with our guests. This one is a little bit out there, so hopefully we can, and I'm pretty sure I'm right on this one, so we'll see. I think I have the right answer, and if I get the wrong answer, people will correct me. Do you know what country caddies originated in?
Caddies? No.
No, okay.
I would naturally guess Scotland, but I have zero clue.
From my understanding, I believe they originated in French or in France, the term caddy coming from the French word of what we call now cadet. I spoke French a little bit in high school, but not very well. So I couldn't even pronounce that properly in French if there's a correct way to pronounce it.
You just say it with French accent, right? Like cadet.
That sounds better than I did. I'll tell you really quick story. I was in French class, third year French. I should know a lot of things. And I could not remember for the life of me how to say you're welcome. And I'm taking a French quiz and I can't remember you're welcome. And that's one of the vocab questions. I'm lying there or I'm just sitting there thinking, my teacher walks in front of me. I knock my pencil on the ground. He picks it up. I say, merci. And then he responds with, you're welcome in French. I'm like, oh, that's it. Thank you, my man. So that shows you my level of French. But
that's about how far it took Spanish too. So
it's passable enough to be able to read a few things and know kind of, but I can't do much.
It is amazing though, when something like that, when I played in a Corn Ferry event down in Mexico one time, I was probably, I don't even know how old I was, but just being forced for a week in total immersion, my caddy was like, it was amazing how much I recalled so quickly with, you know, just derecha and izquierda with, you know, left and right with which direction putts are breaking and everything. Like, but then we just tried to actually have conversations in which was miserable, but at least it kept me not thinking about golf.
That's impressive. Yeah. It's when you get in it, you can do it. And we'll get right to the point after this. My dad lived in Sweden for 6 months when his dad was on sabbatical as a professor and still has friends over there and goes back over there and can still speak it just from that little bit over there. So the kind of what gets ingrained in you can help you through life. And speaking of that, what gets ingrained with you in the golf game can stick with you for life. Before we talk about a lot of different things, let's kind of just start off this year. You've made more, and part of last year, you made more of a commitment to playing more golf, putting yourself under pressure. And as we discussed in the beginning, you see yourself as a player, which is good. And you're kind of getting back in more into playing. Tell us what's been going on.
Well, I made a commitment if I wanted to. I quit my country club back in 2018 when we moved about 20 miles north to Frisco from where I was. And I was planning on joining the club that I wound up joining this year, but then that's when they announced PGA Frisco. And so I was like, well, I got to wait on that to see what it's like, and because it is amazing. But with the pandemic delays and everything else, last year my goal was to play a bunch more, and I did compared to prior years, but I still just don't play that much, and I definitely don't practice my putting nearly enough. So last year, and then last year, the biggest problem was I tore muscle in my calf on the last day of July. So I didn't touch my clubs in August, September, or October. Still entered Champions Tour Q School, which was the week after Thanksgiving. So I played like 8 times over the course of 4 months. And I finished 21st with them taking 18 and 2 ties. So I almost made it to final stage, but you know, my putting was just horrific and whatever. I don't ever play any winter golf just because I hate the cold weather. And so after that, I didn't touch my clubs for about 4 months, which that is going to, unfortunately, you know, they say like, you know, how bad do you want it? And I'm like, well, I don't want it bad enough to play in cold weather. I don't want it bad enough to do cold plunges, even though I know it helped me. But this year, normally I can take the 4 months off that I do and I can find my distance back within a month. And this year it has just not come back. And it's like, oh no, I'm going to actually need to play golf a little bit more year round as I'm now 51. And so this year I joined Stonebriar Country Club here in Frisco with the goal of playing and practicing more. And I really, honestly, I just haven't found my stride yet with a good weekly game to get in out there. I've got my kids every other weekend, which kind of makes it a little bit difficult to get in there. But again, I got to where I was playing pretty good, pretty quickly, like I usually do, and qualified for the U.S. Senior Open. And I've started working. One thing I've realized over the last few years, I had surgery on both my elbows back in 2021. And I've gotten to where I just pick the golf ball off the ground, even with my wedges. So I have no forward shaft lean whatsoever. And even though I've still got 168, 171 ball speed with the driver, which for a 51-year-old, you know, it's so funny that I feel like I have to be apologetic because I play so much golf with Korn Ferry, like young players who are just hitting it 50 past me now. And so I feel like overly apologetic for how short I feel like I'm hitting it. But my short irons have literally gotten comical. I mean, I cannot hit a 54 degree, like consistently 95 yards. Like if I'm 95, 97 yards, I'm starting to consider a gap wedge, which is just hilarious. And the same thing would start going then at 115. I'm starting to consider a pitching wedge. Once I get out to like the 6 iron, I'm carrying it in the low 180s. So I feel like that's a little bit more reasonable. Again, all this is just relative to my ball speed with my driver. And so I was trying to work on lowering the flight a little bit this year, getting more forward shaft lean, and it was working okay. And then over the course of about a month after qualifying for the U.S. Senior Open, like it just went downhill quick. And so now I've qualified for this tournament, and I'm not kidding. On Monday night, I would have taken 77, 77 and not even pegged it because there was no chance I was going to play well. One of the things I think that people don't really understand about PGA Tour players is about just how good they are, is they show up on different grass, different everything, every single week, and just play good. Here I just have basically for a few months been hitting balls either off the mats or off winter rye here in Dallas, which either of those are just easy. And I get up to Newport Country Club, and it's a tight bent grass fairway, and all I can see is either chunking it or thinning it. Like it was brutal, especially too, like the driving range was like sanded. Like if you just top dressed a nice, like putting green, that's rolling like 9. And I just feel like I'm hitting balls out of a fairway bunker with my sand wedge as I'm warming up. And it was just, I mean, I started not freaking out. If I didn't have my meditation practice that you alluded to earlier, I would have been freaking out. And, you know, I get enough altercations on social media that I don't want to give those guys any fodder for like, I thought you could play. And I shot 75-75, which again, I can guarantee you I would have taken that before even pegging it. And you know what I'll say though, again, back to the whole point of the question, I think is I hit it awful. I putted awful. I literally had like 33 and 34 putts and still managed to shoot 75-75 in a U.S. Senior Open, which I'm not saying that's amazing, but for a guy that plays golf about 20 times a year and had absolutely nothing to stand on, that was all just related to strategy and not losing my composure out there. Again, I don't want to go out and shoot 80 something, but you know, that was definitely in play. I don't know that I could have scored too much. This is where it's hard. I don't know that I could have scored too much better than I did, but I also don't know that I could have played too much worse than I did. And so it's like those, both of those can't be true. So I don't know. It's been fun. But now after that, I came home and for about a week, I tried to keep working on what I was working on. And then I wound up shooting 83 in this qualifier at my home course, which it's a hard 76 course rating golf course, but I haven't shot in the 80s since college. I mean, I literally cannot remember the last time I shot in the 80s. And so I decided, okay, I'm going to punt that. I took my kids to Disney for a week and I just went back to one of the things I was working on was trying to get my grip a little bit stronger so that way I could lean the shaft. And I was like, screw that. And I just went back to my super weak grip and just hitting this little flary cut that I always talk about, just shaping the ball one direction. And 2 weeks after shooting 83, I shot 63 on that golf course, again, with a 75.5 course rating, which relative to the course rating has got to be one of the best rounds of my life. And it was just all 18 greens, just on cruise control as much as possible. I'll drop this here just because hopefully you don't have a million listeners, but I played last week in a one-day member guest with Garrett from Good Good, hit all 18 greens, shot 65, and it was just the easiest round of golf ever. And I could see Garrett just like, this is the best round of golf we've ever had on the Good Good channel, like that we've filmed every shot. And I'm like, I'm 51, I'm pretty good. But once you're really not trying to make it more complicated than it is, again, that's relative to whatever your ability is. Again, the game's not that hard. And again, I'm trying to figure out the best way to say that relative to your ability. So if you're an 8, becoming a 5 is not that difficult if you stop trying stuff that's outside of your skill set. Like you're short-sighted, don't try the flop shot. Just pitch it on the green, 2-putt it for bogey. It's what you're probably going to make anyways, just eliminate the silly doubles. You know, so I am kind of excited here. I've got 2 months to the day, basically, until Champions Tour Q School starts. Body feels good. I'm going to maybe, against all intelligent thought, do a little bit of speed training, try to see if I can hurt myself again. But I've got some time now. The greens at my home course are finally getting a little bit more pace, so I'll actually practice my putting. So I'm looking forward to the next 2 months for sure.
Going back to the summer, I just like to talk about that U.S. Senior qualifier. What were your expectations going into that qualifier? And then once you ultimately qualified, what were your expectations going into the tournament?
Well, if you've heard me talk very much before, and again, this is going to sound like a utopian answer, but I don't have expectations. I really don't. And it's taken 51 years of misery of banging my head into the wall to get to that point. I am a big believer that expectations, understanding where you are relative to par, having some sort of a thought in your head about what the cut line's going to be, I don't think any of that's helpful because there's nothing you can do strategically. Like even if you told me I shot 68 to qualify, 69 was the playoff, even if you had told me what the number's going to be, there's nothing I can do strategically in order to try to force that to happen, for lack of a better word. So in a perfect example, like I wasn't playing that good the whole day. And I hit a nice couple shots on a par 5, number 16. I hit a shot up there to a good pitch shot from about 40 yards to like 6 or 8 feet. I read it to be just on the right lip. I hit a great putt and it did not go in. It caught just rolled dead straight, caught the lip. And at that point, like, I think I'm probably dead in the water. So now I'm coming up to a 450 or 60 yard hole that I'm also now going to have to be dropping back to mini driver on. And so like when I'm walking off of 16, like in my opinion, I'm probably not going to make it. And I hit a 6 iron to 20 feet, made it on 17. And then the tees were up on 18, basically even with that tree. And so now I get to hit driver up there, hit a decent wedge to 20 feet and make it for birdie to get in. And so it's like, if I had been thinking all along, you know, like, I've got to be 2 under, 3 under, whatever it is. By the time I get to 17, I would have been even more deflated. But it's like, I'm just going to play this round of golf and see how it finishes up at the end. And again, like I say, I know that's a utopian answer, but it is the correct answer. Now, again, it's taken a lot of blood, sweat, and tears to get it to where I can do that. But again, that is the correct way to play golf, in my opinion. Emotions, attachment to outcome, all that stuff is what winds up making you just implode mentally and start making emotional decisions, start trying to force things. And I'm a firm believer that A, it's possible to get to this like sublime state in golf. I would never, trust me, my friends that I travel playing professional golf with laugh at the fact that I teach kind of the mental side of the game now. Like, you just have never seen a bigger lunatic on the golf course than I was back in the day. So again, meditation being the first and foremost superpower that Tiger had over everyone back in the day. And now the vast majority of players have, whether they want to call it a meditation routine or not, they have some sort of a priming, get yourself into the zone. Like, historically, the zone just seemed like this, you know, mystical, elusive state. And now we just kind of realize it's really just a moving meditation. Again, rewinding back to last Thursday with Garrett and this one day member guest, I was curious, like, I've been on podcasts before where I know it's going to go out to 10, 20, 30,000 people. I've spoken at MIT's analytics conference and Wharton's economics conference. Like, I've spoken in front of big crowds, and yeah, I'm nervous, but like, all I'm doing is talking. This is the first time I'm ever going to play golf in a situation where I know somewhere between 500,000 and a million people are going to see this video. And I was really curious, like, am I going to be freaking out? And just understanding like that's the point of doing all of this work in advance. And then I just, again, I won't say I accidentally fell into the zone, but I just really felt so comfortable and like floated around the golf course the entire day. I mean, again, when the video comes out, you're just going to look at this thing and be like, this is the best ball striking round I've ever seen. I was -1.5 putting and shot 7 under. I mean, like, I'm not the guy that's like, coulda, shoulda, woulda, but like, that could have easily been 61. And if I hit decent wedges, like 59's in play.
That's impressive. I think that's one of the things that Cooper and I enjoy about this podcast, is getting to talk to lots. We get to talk to lots of people, so we get to learn a lot of things. But for us, at least to me, it's easy to get all this knowledge and not put any of it in practice. Then you go out and play, and on the bad days, you get kicked in the teeth and you remember, oh, this isn't just theoretical. This is real life, and this is what people are going through. As you've gotten back to playing more competitive golf, as you've gotten back to, or as you played in the U.S. Senior Open, and as you go through Q School, what sorts of things do you, and maybe there's nothing, but what sorts of things do you empathize more with players now, being in those, empathize with players more now that you're in that environment as well?
That's the fact that by definition, regardless of what your handicap or ability is, you're going to play bad 25-33% of the time, whatever you want to define bad as. Your worst 25% of rounds are your worst 25% of rounds. And I think that's one of the amazing things about guys like Garrett and these YouTubers. They catch so much grief. It's like, well, I'm recording every round of golf I play. So yeah, some of them are going to be bad. Some are going to be good. You're going to think I'm amazing. That's the same way with PGA Tour players. Like, Scotty finished whatever he did, 30th or 40th in the second FedEx Cup event, I think, or in the U.S. Open. He's played bad twice this year, but it's like, coming into it, it's like, oh, is the pressure getting to him? Like, no, it's, he didn't play good. Like, that's fine. Where it starts to implode on you is if you start overthinking it, you start out there on the course trying to change what you're doing. Again, most people, like, let's just pretend for ease of math, your scoring average is 76, so 38 per nine. If you turn it 40 one day, your scoring average is not 76 anymore. It's now 78. Let's don't make it an 80, because that's when people typically turn a little bit higher than they would expect. Oh, I got to get it back. Like, well, now you're going to make a couple silly doubles. But again, this is why, in my opinion, checking out what you are relative to par, checking out on, or rather, is, it's really hard to do, but it's just the, I think it's the key to not, A, having more fun, but B, not turning a good round into a worse round. Like, again, when we finished, Garrett, he was like, what were you? And I'm like, I don't know. And he's like, seriously, don't. I'm like, I mean, I know I was 6, 7, 8 under something like that, but I do not know what I was. And that was, I mean, that was the truth. I really had no idea. And again, that way, hey, I've got a great round going here. Oh my God, a million people are going to watch this video. Holy, you know, what can I get it to? Like, there wasn't any of that. It was just, let's keep hitting golf shots and we'll add them up. And again, that is like, I believe the most cliche saying in golf, just hit shots and add them up at the end. But like, what else can you do? I mean, there's literally nothing else you can do. And again, you pick proper strategy, you set that out in advance, and then you just go execute the plan. It's like, what is that saying? Like, you plan to execute and fail to plan, or whatever that thing is where you're just like, you have to have a plan and then you have to stick to it. Just because I'm 2 over and I want to be 4 under doesn't matter. The golf course does not matter, or the golf course doesn't care what you think you should be at all.
You mentioned, you know, 51, you got kids, you got life going on outside of golf. This isn't your full-time job playing golf. It can be hard, at least I know from experience, and you said yourself, playing and getting time to practice, yet you still maintain a high level of play. What are the, generally speaking, like, what are the swing thoughts / things that you're working on in the moments when you get to work on your swing, if at all?
As always, shaping the ball one direction. I mean, I firmly believe, well, that's a fact with driver. I was actually talking to a college kid the other day and I was like, what's your preferred shape of driver? He's like, I'm pretty good at working it both ways. I'm like, no, you're not. Like, you simply are not. I know you think you are. And this is where there's that great video with Cameron Young that made its way around, like him hitting the 9 ball flights and like, oh my God, look at this. And it's like, what was he aiming at? Because he wasn't aiming at this. The balls did not go to remotely the same place. I would assume he should have been aiming at the same thing and showing me with a 9 ball flight going back to the same target. They were all over the place. And again, I've worked with Zalatoris since he was 9 years old, and that kid can hit a nine ball drill like you can't imagine. And then he gets out on the course and he's not as good at certain shots and shapes. And it's like, then why are we making this harder than it needs to be? So first and foremost, especially with the driver, is working at one direction only. And the reason that is, I'm not dying on this hill. Everyone that's arguing against me is dying on the hill. Like, I hate saying it, but I'm like, I'm just dominating you in this debate, because the driver is the only club in the bag that is fit for one shape. So again, my driver, 170 ball speed, 14 degree launch, 2200 RPM spin, like pretty optimal launch numbers. If I take that same driver and try to draw it, spin rates are going to fall. Like, that's why it's like, yeah, every once in a while. I mean, again, I played in a scramble the other day where my buddy on the last hole had hit a great drive that kind of rode the wind a little bit. The wind is off the right. The only way I was going to hit it past him was by hitting a giant high toe draw. If I hit my normal fade, it's going to be basically exactly where he is, because I'm going to get eaten up by the wind. So yeah, I did. And actually I pulled it off. But you could see this ball in the air. It was like 1500 RPM. And so, yeah, it was cool and it worked out great on that hole. But if I happen to not catch that correctly, it's just a knuckleball that could kind of go anywhere. Definitely going to smother hook more into this hazard that was left. And so first and foremost, working the driver specifically one way. I do cut every iron also. It's going to be very rare that I would try to draw. The only reason that I would be trying to draw a shot is if the green is pretty deep, the pin's on the back, and I'm between two clubs, but I'm not trusting. So like, the wind is off the right, and I'm worried that if I hit like a 6 iron, there's one specific shot that comes to my mind on this number 9. It's a par 3 here in Gentle Creek. If I hit this 6 iron and I don't cut hold it correctly, it's going to go straight and it's going to be way too much club. So in that scenario, because the green's pretty big, basically, I did try to draw a 7 iron, ride the wind a little bit. That's going to be almost the only time I'm going to try to draw an iron. And what I try to tell players is, if you're trying to work an iron the opposite direction of your stock shot, and the reason is a better look at birdie, that's not a good enough reason. I was trying to make this club the correct club because I was worried the other club was going to bring in more bogeys than is necessary. And, you know, this is actually one of the things I was creating an Instagram post for a second ago, before we got on, but I couldn't quite figure out how to do it. Trying to get a ball to 20 feet versus 40 feet. Like, it's just not that big of a difference. I mean, it's I'd rather you be 20 feet than 40 feet. But the post that I'm actually working on is the difference in 4 feet and 6 feet on the PGA Tour is 0.21 shots. So it's just a little bit over 0.2. The difference in 30 feet and 60 feet, I would think a 30 foot is materially easier than a 60 footer when compared to a 4 footer versus a 6 footer. Does that setup make sense? It's the identical expected value difference. So every putt, I mean, again, this is why lag putting, second thing I would like to work on more, is shaping the ball one direction and getting really good at lag putting. Because I just, if you can roll it inside of 4-ish feet, you are just picking up so much against your competition. This is where Zalatoris, again, I know it's obviously easy to make fun of his putting strokes aesthetically, but like the guy was second in approach putt performance, which is the average length of your second putt on the PGA Tour. Not last year was so riddled with injuries, I don't even consider it. But the prior year when he won, he's got the best speed control on tour, which actually makes his make rates from outside 15 feet above tour average. It makes his three putt avoidance better than tour average, and while also having pretty bad, you know, make rates inside of 10 feet. So we tap in a whole bunch. We actually make more because we have made the hole bigger. And then beyond that, just not hitting bad chip shots. I don't have enough time to work on my game to where I'm going to be hitting crazy flop shots or anything like that. I just don't want to hit bad chip shots. So I want to shape the driver one direction, pretty much want to shape the irons one direction. I don't want to hit bad chip shots. And I would, again, the thing that sucks is the new home course that I joined, the greens have been a lot slower than I would had anticipated. And then once you're punching Bermuda and everything, like I just feel like all summer I have not practiced my speed control a single time. This is where I get in arguments on Twitter with guys like Brad Faxon, who's obviously one of the best putters in the history of the game, about, hey, putting's easy, just all speed control. I'm like, well, then why are you a bad putter, Scott? Well, I don't ever work on my speed control. So, you know, if I can find time over the next 2 months, I'm sure it can't get worse. So hopefully that's what I need to focus on.
So back in your playing days, you played in the, I believe it was a 2005 U.S. Open at Pinehurst.
The 99 one.
99 U.S. Open.
Both at Pinehurst, so good call.
I knew it was at Pinehurst because, of course, this year's U.S. Open was at Pinehurst. From your level of perspective there, after playing in the U.S. Open at Pinehurst and then 25 years later watching the U.S. Open at Pinehurst, how much better do you think the best players are? And say if you put Bryson with current skill level and equipment, how much lower do you think he would have scored in 99? And then consequently, whoever won in 99, I'm not sure who it was, what do you think they would have scored on today's setup playing against current players?
You're as much of a historian as I am. That's the one that Payne won. I feel like that's the one that...
I'm really dumb.
I couldn't tell you who won in 2002, but I feel like, and it's one of those funny things like, well, maybe you only know that because you played in it, but I feel like just because it was Payne and then he died, I feel like most people would know that one.
I was thinking 2005, Michael Campbell, but yeah, Payne Stewart.
I mean, they're just so much better now. It's a joke. I mean, it's just literally not even close. Back, I mean, I'm again, 51. I played professionally, got out of college in 96, played through 02. Yeah, you know, I'm 6'1", 230, not fat. Like, I'm a pretty big dude. I was a total anomaly back in the day, size-wise, and I wasn't this big back then. But these guys, you walk on the tour event, the range on a tour event now, you literally feel like you could be at, I'm trying to think of the right football position, but like you feel like you could be at a clinic for college guards in basketball. I mean, very fewer people. Again, I'm going to say stuff that people could easily go double check. If you're 5'10", you're probably pretty ripped. Most of these guys are 6 foot, 6'1", 6'2" now. I mean, some of them are just physical specimens. Whereas back in the day, you've got guys out there smoking, they're fat. Like, I do believe that whenever I was growing up, golf was a skill, kind of like throwing darts is a skill. And people are like, it's not a sport. Golf is a sport now. I mean, especially at the highest level. I mean, sure, you got your weekend warriors that are still just fat and smoking and drinking. But if you're playing the game at the highest level, you are an absolute athlete. I played last week in the Texas Mid-Am qualifier with Bryce Verplank, Scott's nephew. And he's 6'5", 6'6", 240. I mean, and he pitched at Texas and Oklahoma State. He looks like Curt Schilling. I mean, and we get up there on the first hole and he's like, all right, this is going to sound ridiculous, guys, but I need to wait for the green to clear. And I grab my laser and I'm like, hey, dude, I believe you. I'm just curious. And I laser the guys on the green at 370. And he's like, I've won two, you know, PDLA events last year. Like, I can bring it. And I'm like, again, I don't expect you to flare this one 310, man. I believe you. And he proceeds to hit it over the green. And I'm just like, that's bonkers. I mean, and again, he shot 7 under. There's no way he drives the ball as well as he did this day, every day, because he would be the best player on the planet. And again, I'm 168, 170 ball speed on the 13th hole. He hit it 105 yards past me. The next hole was 310. He hit 2 iron over the green. I mean, just... So that's just stuff that did not exist with people that could actually play golf back in the day. And side diatribe, I do believe that 190, maybe 195 is the maximum usable ball speed to play professional golf. Like at some point, the shot pattern is just too big. The knuckleballs especially are just too penal, which we all hit a couple knuckleballs around, whether you actually realize it or not. And at those speeds, you know, at 200 miles an hour, a knuckleball is three fairways over or two streets over, whichever one of those is in play. So I don't remember how much better were the players now? It's just, again, it's just literally not even close. I mean, and it's unfortunate because, you know, people like, well, the scoring average hasn't changed much. I'm like, well, the golf course has. I mean, the golf course is a couple hundred yards longer. The pins are for sure more tucked. Like everything about it, it's so much more of a circus. I mean, again, if you took those guys that were fat and alcoholics back in the day and stuck them in front of, you know, 20,000 people and 15 million on the line, they would not be able to pull the trigger back. I mean, their body would have just went into shutdown mode. So golf is a sport now, and these are actual athletes.
Question about speed and 190 being, you know, the potential maximum usable ball speed. I want to get to what you do for speed training, but first, to the maximum usable ball speed point, do you think that that means that guys will stop swinging or work up to 190 ish and then cap out there, except for maybe a few freaks who can't help it? Or do you think that that means that guys will work their maximum ball speed up to that level, but then, and this is where the like tough part of the question, at least to me, is when I think about it, or will they work up to higher ball speeds with driver, but play with less than driver in the bag, or make equipment adjustments so that they're essentially dampening the effect on the ball? Because essentially, as long as, from what I'm understanding, like for the most part, as long as we're talking about like knuckleballs, you know, balls going out crazy distances, the root cause of it is not, you know, guys are swinging out of their shoes, and so the club face variability is higher because they're swinging it faster. It's purely because they're swinging it faster, you know, ball goes farther, dispersion is net greater, and it's the same. It's like, it's essentially the inverse of the rollback debate and how they've characterized that language, where ball will go straighter because they're just not hitting it as far.
People ask me all the time, what have I learned over the last 10 years? And I typically say, not much. I mean, this is just math. I mean, at the point that it's a solved problem, there's not much else to learn. But what I will say, especially this year, 4 or 5 years ago, whenever it was that Jamie Sadlowski, the guy that won the World Long Drive a few times, he was trying to play professional golf, and I was doing some work with him. And I wasn't really advising him on his swing, but I was definitely like, you need to hit it shorter. And I definitely was like, you probably need to do that by swinging softer. That's a really difficult thing for those guys to do. Kyle Berkshire hit me up this year because he's wanting to play professional golf. And what I said to him, I'm like, I don't want you to swing softer. I want you to get a club that goes shorter, even with your not your long drive swing, because that's just absolutely insane, but like your cruiser gaming swing. I don't want you to feel like you're swinging slow. And so whether that's going to a 13 degree mini driver, whatever it needs to be, 43 inch, you need to get the equipment to handcuff you more than changing your swing. I do believe that most guys, you know, I mean, Matthew Fitzpatrick, I've worked with Matthew in the past. He paid me to work with his brother, Alex. Like, I like the guy, but like, so don't take this the wrong way, Matthew, if you're listening, but he's a small dude. He's not someone you would be expecting to get it in the 180s. If Matthew Fitzpatrick can get it in the 180s, anyone on tour can get it in the 180s. And I do believe that once you've got optimal launch numbers in the 180s, chasing more, I don't know. I don't think it's necessary because it is diminishing. And it's funny, like since I'm not an instructor, I really don't study the TrackMan data much, but it is diminishing. So like I can get it up to 178 or 80. Like that's like if I'm just trying to swing my hardest and I happen to catch it. But I do believe actually in those swings, my average overall distance would drop because I'm only going to catch it so often. Let's even say that's 20% of the time. And this is what I screwed up way back in the day when I was playing professionally and the great big Berthas and the longer shafts were starting to come out. And I would just sit there on the range and just hit them without taking them onto the course. And I was always like, I hit my 43.5 inch, the Cobra that everyone played back in the day, driver, just fine. I'm hitting this one all over the face. And what I never bothered to do is go out to the course and be like, well, yeah, you are hitting it all over the face. And the one that's go all over the face is as long as your current driver. But every once in a while, you do catch it. And so I do believe that going with that equipment, because I wasn't changing my swing, that was just equipment was making it go further. But it didn't seem like it to me. And again, I just believe that to be true. Once you've got optimal numbers in the 180s, it's pretty damn good. I mean, so I've got optimal numbers in the 168, 70 range again. And if I try to swing harder, I don't know that it actually goes on average further. It goes occasionally further, like that one shot that I hit on the last hole on Monday in the scramble. I cannot do that with my normal swing, but I already had a ball out there in play. That's not the way it works in golf. You don't ever have a ball out there in play. I would not have done that if I were just playing a stroke play event. So I've been saying this since day one, and I'm the guy that originally told Bryson to hit it as far as you possibly can. I'm definitely, I would say, the guy that has led this revolution on tour more than anyone else of let's get as long as we possibly can. But I've also said since day one, I originally was thinking 190, again, because the arguments I got into with the golf course architects and historians on Twitter would be like, you know, distance is going to compound. And how long is it going to have to be? I'm like, not any longer than it is now. Like, they're not going to hit it to over 200 and play on tour. Like, that's just not going to happen. I mean, it's just, at some point, you're running into someone's pool. I mean, eventually.
You answered it well and answered most of what I was getting at. The only thing that I had thought about, and I think this is more golf in a vacuum versus actually playing on a golf course, but the only upside, let's say 190 is the maximum, or like the, you know, right around the maximum usable ball speed, the upside of, you know, getting higher than that, assuming that our face variability isn't really changing and none of the other factors are changing that much. And maybe that's a big assumption to make, but
that's a flawed, that's a very flawed assumption for playing golf.
Yeah.
But carry on.
Yeah. Let's say our face variability stays approximately the same, which I think, well, I'm pulling off of stuff that I've heard a long time or a while back, so I'm not going to pull off that. But the upside to that is our spin loft or our D plane is better, relatively speaking. So like, you know, it's like, it's the advantage of hitting an 8 iron while other guys are hitting a 7 iron, because we're presenting more loft. And so the ball will essentially go straighter because more of it's being, I know I'm not saying that perfectly, but because more,
but
of
what
that,
you're trying to say is like, yeah, a sand wedge, you hit straighter than a 4 iron.
Yes.
Once we've gotten up to the driver, again, I don't know this to be the case, but it certainly seems exponential. It's just easier to knock the spin axis offline, meaning hit big cuts or big draws. That's the face variability is just so much more important than it is with a sand wedge. So again, with the driver specifically, but again, in most of the research out there, Bubba, like, let's just pretend, I could probably use a more modern example than Bubba, but Bubba's hitting his 8 iron 170. And let's say Tim Clark is hitting his 6 iron 170. Directionally, they hit them about the same. Bubba's advantage is height and trajectory. And so what you were kind of starting to say there was the more loft allows it to go straighter. I mean, that would be true in a vacuum, but I don't believe that's actually true in practice. But again, the advantage comes from trajectory and spin. So yes, it is better to be hitting that more lofted club, but it's not because of directional control.
Got it. Okay. So it's more, and so that's why we wouldn't see that at the driver. That comports switching gears to speed training for yourself, you mentioned you came back this year and from the winter and things were not what you would have hoped they would have been. What does speed training look like for you getting up to speed for the events this fall?
I'm a fan of the Ripstick. I just think it's the best design. It's got a counterbalance, which helps with, you know, just wearing your joints out and everything. But then it's a very simple device to take weight in and out of. Obviously, the other speed sticks, you've got to have three different clubs. I do think the Stack is a very good alternative. My understanding is that the nut on the end of it has a tendency to come loose, which is obviously a big problem. But more importantly to me, the difference in those two, the Ripstick is the actual length of a driver, which again, just for me, it felt weird swinging a 42-inch club, which again, I know that's not the point of speed training. Well, we're not working on our swing here. It just felt weird to me because it's a different plane. It's a different dynamic. So really, I don't look at any of the protocols or anything. I just take the thing and I swing it as hard as I can 10 times, rest a little bit, swing as hard as I can 10 times. Again, I think Sasho and those guys with the Stack have done a lot of great research to show we don't need to be doing the left-handed swings unless you really are just trying to hurt yourself. You know, we've got to have a braking mechanism. I get it, but that's to me more what gym work is about. That's one of the things I don't think people realize with Bryson was how much work he did getting his body ready to handle the load while beginning the speed training work with Como. And again, where it really went off the charts was, again, Como's little living room lab is just down the street from me. I mean, Chris and I met playing an underground poker room back in 2004. So I've got to go over and watch some training and see what they were doing while the tour was shut down in the pandemic. And so then he came back and he literally had gained 30-ish yards, whatever it is, because he got to just go wheels off on it. And that's just not really something that's going to happen again. But it felt like it was overnight, but that was really 18 months in the making. But the real, like the cherry on top was that 3 months, 4 months, whatever it was of shutdown during the pandemic, because it was like, oh, I've got my body ready to roll now. Now let's really start jacking this thing up. I do believe that what he has accomplished in golf, it's like one of the greatest feats in sport. Like, and again, I know that sounds like hyperbole. There's not anyone outside of the baseball era and the steroid era in baseball that did as much to transform their game as he did. I mean, that's just, it's literally insane. I mean, so back to being the first guy that told him to hit it further, this is all the way back in 2014. You know, I caddied for Zalatoris when he won the Texas A&M US Junior in 2014. I taught everything to DeChambeau in 2015. But the way I work with players, I don't watch them play golf. I went up to caddy for Zalatoris in the Pac Coast Am at Eugene Country Club, and we played a practice round with Bryson. And the first like four holes, super tight, as you might imagine, in Oregon. And he's just hitting his little fairway finder. And I'm like, yay, that's cute, whatever. And first of all, he's not finding the fairway anyways with his fairway finder. And then on five, I finally was like, all right, dude, I want to see the big ball. Like, show me what you got. And, you know, it wasn't a hole that you would actually hit it on, but he just tees it up an extra inch and puts an extra 15 miles an hour of ball speed on it. Like, I was like, what are we doing? Like, you can't leave that in the tank. And he's like, he had this completely articulate response of like, my body can't handle it. I feel like we're going to blah, 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 blah. And I would love to go back to that 20-year-old DeChambeau and be like, you realize you're going to lose in the finals of the world long drive contest in 7 years. Like it would blow his mind, because I couldn't even get him to swing hard, let alone, I mean, like really hard. Like I just couldn't get him to do what he's even capable of without thinking he's going to hurt himself. And again, he had all this over answer in physics and why you can't do that. And I'm just like, yeah, you can. Again, last thing that I'll randomly spew on about. After he won the U.S. Open in 2020, I tweeted immediately that the tour was about to become a circus for the next 5 years while everyone tried to figure out this speed training, because everyone was just going to try to swing harder. That was my point of talking about all the body work he did in advance to get ready for it. And I was just like, everyone's going to go out there and just try to swing harder. They're all going to hurt themselves. They're going to screw up their swings. Like, this is going to be comical to watch. And I was surprised that Rory was the first one a few months later that came out after he started driving each other. I was like, you know, I really just started chasing speed and trying to hit it harder. And it's like, it's not about just swinging faster. It's about swinging faster, A, the correct way. I mean, if you watch Bryson, he's got that right foot at address where he slams that down to get his swing started. Because it's like that Berkshire bounce back and forth move. you really are having to get that weight moving quicker going back, as opposed to Rory's just trying to like swing it faster. It's just, again, I'm not criticizing Rory. He's my top three favorite players. I still am just upselling him like, dude, call me because I can help you with some of the dumb stuff you do on the golf course. But he went about trying to gain length the wrong way. And so, you know, again, circling back to, I'm a big believer in the ripstick. I'm a big believer in getting your body right before you even try that, because you will hurt yourself. If you don't have the proper hip flexors, rotator cuff, like all these, so boring. Like my workouts, I just go to the gym and basically do like a 1995 linebacker workout. Like I do not golf specific train. It's probably a combination of vanity and combination of, I just get bored doing like these little hip flexor drills. But if you go back in DeChambeau's YouTube channel way back, maybe a year or two back, he actually had Garrett from Good Good at his home gym, and they were going through what his workout is. And so much of it is just boring little laying on your stomach, doing hip flexor things, all kinds of rotator cuff stuff. And I'm just like, hard pass.
What are some of the dumb things that Rory does on the course that you'd like to help him with?
Shaping driver both direction, first and foremost, not focusing on his speed enough. I believe in putting, you know, not to keep on dunking on Faxon, but Faxon does not understand that importance. He was just an anomaly of a person who just had great speed. He's always working on line control with people. He thinks that he did not leave any putts short, when in fact he left 1 in 6 putts from 15 to 20 feet short. If I just could get Rory and be like, dude, don't work on your stroke at all for the next 3 months and purely do these two speed drills, not to upsell the Decade app, but I've got a speed drill that I had Zalatoris do the entire time he's in college, the foundations speed drill, where, again, I'm not saying that we're going to go mimic his short putting, but if you could mimic his long putting, it would be amazing. That's why, paradoxically, at Augusta, he does so well, because speed is more important than your line. And that's why the year after he finished second in the Masters, everyone's like, he's a betting favorite in the British. Like, no, because everyone's speed is good when the greens are slow and straight. So, again, understanding what works well. And then the other speed drill that I would have Rory do is, Maverick McNealy modified that main speed drill that I'm talking about to be applicable from 5 to 15 feet. And it's like, and then he led strokes gained putting, not last season, the season before, on the PGA Tour. And it's like, here's the two drills, one of the best guy with speed control on long putts on tour, and one with the best strokes gained putting overall on tour, which those players separate themselves the most from 5 to 12 feet, the best putters on tour. So here are the two drills, Rory, I would do. I would stop shaping your driver both directions. I would honestly probably tell him to hit a cut instead of a draw. But again, this gets back to the idea that when he's trying to hit the same driver both directions, the driver is just not fit for that. Like again, irons, it doesn't really matter. Like when you're trying to draw your 7 iron, it's really just your 6 iron. And when you're trying to cut your 7 iron, it's really just your 8 iron. If you're going against your stock shot, he seems to make some strategical decisions that aren't necessarily the best. Again, that one video that got posted a couple weeks ago, I think it was during the Tour Championship, I don't remember, where he cut it in the right water. Like, he should not be hitting a cut there. He should just be hammering his draw. And, you know, that's just a silly little mistake.
Speaking of putting, I think I'd seen you post something on social media. I wanted to talk about it. I think you talked about Tour Read. You've been trying that out. I wanted to come in. We've had Ralph on before. I like Ralph, and I really like Tour Read. I'm a guy who's obviously conventional green reading, everyone is familiar with. I've done Tour Read, swear by it, did Aim Point, and I actually, believe it or not, someone was looking for it on Twitter the other day, and I was able to help them out. I still have a Vector putting booklet. Vector, but yeah. Oh, yeah, I've had that since 2012, just stored in random booklets that I have, and was able to break it out and show that to them. But so
I've got the original Aim Point chart when it's got like the clock in there. Oh, man. I did an Aim Point clinic with John Graham. I swear it had to be 2010 or 11 out here at Craig Ranch. I mean, Tour Read is it's amazing. If you think about it, Aim Point, if we got a 12-foot putt, it has one break. So if we're calibrating, we're all doing the same, we should get the same answer, whether you're having to hold your fingers further from your face and I'm closer or whatever, like there is an answer. And what Ralph's system does is just break that down into a very simple mathematical equation, which, again, people get scared of math, but if you can do 6 times 2, you can do the math from there. Like, you don't have to do anything more difficult than multiplying by 2 in any stage of the game here. And it's just the other thing that Ralph taught me that I always said with Aimpoint, I'm like, you know, I'm just not very good at feeling the slope. And Ralph was like, well, what you want to do is figure out what the minimum amount of slope you can feel is, and then see what the minimum amount of slope you can see is. And then you work from there. So the minimum I can see is about 0.5. The minimum I can feel is about 1. And so, like, if I can see it but not feel it, I know it's somewhere in that window. If I can feel it, then I know it's 1. And then from there, I don't even try to gauge if it's 2 or 3. It's like, well, that's more than 1, but it's not ridiculous. Well, that's probably a 2. Or that's, why did they put a pin there starting to get be a 3? And again, really in decent golf tournaments, you're not going to get it much more than a 3 very often. So I don't even really worry about beyond that. I mean, and then it really is, it's a function then back to speed control. If we've got a 15-foot putt, and it's, again, a video in the Decade app, I've got Aaron Wise hitting 20 20-foot putts, just literally hitting the same putt over and over and over again. And all he's trying to do is lag it on top of a fake cup. And his shot pattern was about 4 feet deep with basically perfect line control and about 4 feet deep. And what's important to realize about that then is, let's say we've got a 15 footer that's breaking 2 cups outside the right. If I hit the putt that I accidentally hit 2 feet shorter than I intended to, that putt's going to start breaking sooner. That's going to miss the hole low, not because of my read or because of my start line, but because of my speed control. If I hit the putt that goes 2 feet further than I expected, that's going to miss the pole high. Again, not because of my read or not because of my line control, but because of my speed control. So if you think of like a swarm of like 50 bees and they all start on the exact same line, but then they start just breaking wider apart as they get towards the hole, some part of the hole is still going to, like, I'm always using this microphone as example, but some part of the hole is going to accidentally get in the way of the swarm of bees. Like, again, your make rate is better the tighter you can control your speed and keep that bee hive together, more of the holes going to interact with it. But still, it's almost impossible for whatever line and read, again, assuming you're trying, whatever line and read you give, that there's not some speed component that will actually make it go in. I mean, again, back to that, your start line relative to your ability, blah, 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 blah. It's just not that, it's pretty damn good. I had 5 mulligans in the scramble on Monday, and I hit a putt on about a 20 footer that I thought was about a cup outside the left, and it just rolled dead straight. And my buddies were like, want to use a mulligan on this one? I'm like, hell yeah, I will make this in the next 2 putts. It's dead straight. And I made the next one. I mean, again, like, you tell me a putt straight. I played in a scramble for the pro-am for Furyk and Friends, the Champions Tour event last year. And there's a 45-foot putt, like part of the pro-am, that was dead straight. And again, anomaly, sample size, whatever. But like, I knew standing over this putt, it's going to go within a cup left or right of it. Like, it's going to have a chance. Whereas if you put me on the same length putt and it's breaking, I mean, what's a 4-foot break on a 45 footer wouldn't be outrageous. There's almost no chance I'm getting it within a cup left and right. I mean, so again, it's not start line. And if you think back to your last bad putting round, and let's pretend you're actually trying, you went to the putting green and you worked on your stroke. No one has a bad putting round and goes and does speed drills. Literally nobody does. And so understanding, like, it probably wasn't your line, and almost as important, if it is your line, that's like months and months of work that you've got to do to fix that problem. So yes, we want to be working on that, obviously, but also you can materially improve your speed in just 2 or 3 hours of speed drills.
I want to get back to that, but there's something that you said there that I thought was interesting. It reminded me of an article I'd read, and you said you were standing over the ball and knew you were going to make it. And it's just an interesting thought, at least for me, it's an interesting thought. You know, every golfer has that feeling, knows what that feeling is like. And there was an article Cooper had sent me by some guy who played at Princeton, wrote it for NLU. It was like an offensive eye test. Maybe it was I don't know if you've read the article or are familiar with it.
Sensitive eye test? Is that what you said?
It was called In Defense of the Eye Test. But one of the things he mentioned is something that's familiar, and that's what I'm getting at, is something that's familiar to all of us, is standing over the ball like on a putt and knowing, oh, we're going to make it. And in that moment where it feels like we're transcending the odds. I guess my question is, like, from your perspective, what is that?
I don't know, man. It's spooky because there's not many times. It'd be interesting to know which one you're referring to. Like, and again, it certainly might be hindsight is 20/20. But there's a couple, even the Texas Mid-Am qualifier, I wound up in a playoff, shot 67, wound up in a playoff. And on the second hole, I had a 7-footer that was about a cup outside the left. And I just was like, oh, this is going in. Like there was no doubt, and then made it dead center. The other one that's comical that I remember from is like Q School in like 2010, 11, or 12. Actually, that might have been the last time I entered when I was 49. That might have just been in like 2021. I don't remember. But I definitely think it was from way before. I had a chip shot where I was not in a good spot at all, but I had like a really nice lie, but I was short-sighted and over it. I was like, this is going in. Like, I don't know what it was. And again, I don't have that feeling often. I had a buddy who literally every time we walk on a par three, he claims, all right, this one's going in. He's like, eventually I'll be right. I don't have that feeling necessarily very often. But again, hindsight's 20/20. Man, when I feel like I do, it's amazing how it goes in. So to your question, like, how do we get that? I have no idea. And I have, again, it's just weird sometimes. I mean, again, back to that 65 I just shot with Garrett, like I've never for 18 straight holes. I mean, I've literally never for 18 straight holes stood over every single shot and thought, this is going to be perfect. I mean, like there was no doubt in my mind, especially with the irons, this is going to go exactly where I'm pointing it. I hit two bad drives throughout the day. But like still, it'd be back to working one way, they were just flares. Like they're barely in the right rough. Like once you're really good at working the ball one direction, it's not, some guy posted on Instagram the other day, when you're hitting it straight, trying to hit it straight, and you're aiming the middle of a 30-yard wide fairway, you've only got 15 yards either side to miss it. Whereas if you're trying to play a cut, you've got 30. I'm like, well, it's still 30 yards. But I do believe that keeping the face on the target side of path, doing that consistently makes you able to feel it more, to where my miss, like again, what just feels like a terrible flare is just barely in the right rough. And I'm rarely going to double cross one again, materially into trouble. So circling back to your question, I don't know, man. Cause again, like that's something you could like try to like, well, how can I get that feeling every time? Like, I don't think that you can, but again, also circling back to meditation, I think that even recognizing in real time, well, this is kind of a silly thought. Like, it's great to have confidence, but it's probably a stupid thought.
Maybe, but I mean, you know how you have that feeling and then it goes in and you're like, dang, I knew that was going in. I'd rather go into every shot like feeling like that than the, you know, 4-footer downhill slider. I'm like, this could break 2 inches. This could break 1 inch, this could break 0.
That more, I would say that's one to reset on. So one thing, I've got a video in the Decade app that's just the title of it is Don't. And what that means is if you have any iteration of the word don't in your head, you have to start over. Like you don't know what you're doing. So if you're just over the ball and you're like kind of daydreaming, I don't think you need to start over. You need to be like, hey, let's pay attention here. But if you're like, I don't know if it's going to break 1 inch, 2 inch, or 3 inch, you're just not ready to hit the shot. So more than, hey, I want to feel good about what I'm doing, I don't want to feel confused about what I'm doing. I do believe the vast majority of anomaly shots come from either trying to work it both ways too much and the double cross. Double cross is just always off the planet, or some iteration of the word don't in your head. Don't go left. I don't know what the wind is doing. I don't really trust this club. I don't know what the break's going to be. Any iteration of the word don't is a hard reset.
That's fair. I think, I mean, maybe Rory could have used that over at Pinehurst a few times because he had a few of those tough ones coming down the stretch where it had to, especially on that last one, it had to feel, I don't know, looking from above before they showed the putt, I saw that even though it was a shorter putt, I was like, man, that thing could really crack and it feels hard to get that one.
Yeah, I don't think the general public has no idea how hard that putt actually was.
Well, I mean, when the announcer said this is left lip, I'm like, well, then he's about to miss this thing 6 inches left because he's got this about a cup and a half outside left. And I mean, that's just such a hard putt on greens that are that fast and bumpy. Like, that putt's brutal. Now, the prior one, I would like to get into his head and see what was going on there. I can't remember how he got it there. I can't remember if he almost made the putt, but I feel like there was, in my opinion, whatever it was at the time, there was some holdover, potentially holdover effect from a prior shot where he was either not quite paying attention or just what, I can't remember exactly what made me feel that, but I felt like the first one on like 16 or whatever it was, like there was something mental on that one. The one on 18 was just a really hard putt.
Yeah, that makes sense. I'll send you back to the article. I'll send you over that article once we're done. It was interesting. Once you read it, it was a solid article. Quick gist, and then I'll get back to close to wrapping up. The quick gist of it was, which was something at least to me was worth considering, by breaking, not that strokes gained is bad, but by breaking all the shots down, we look at the components rather than the sum of the parts. And so then maybe we miss things along the way, like how guys, maybe there are things that transcend our ability to capture in statistics, especially with strokes gained.
Well, strokes gained is amazing compared to the old stuff. It's amazing for sure, but it's not perfect. And more importantly, again, we track something called the Tiger Five in the Decade app, which is how many bogeys on par fives, how many doubles, how many three putts, how many bogeys. Tiger technically tracked bogey with 9 iron or less, and then blown easy saves, which again is subjective to his opinion. So we track 2 chips. If you feel like you should have shot lower on any given day, which we all do 100% of the time, and it's not one of those 5 things, you're kidding yourself. Like, I mean, again, when I shot that 63, we finished the round and literally one of the best rounds of golf I've ever played. And the guy that I'm playing, he's like, man, that could have been really special. I'm like, what? And he's like, well, I mean, obviously it was, but you missed a couple of 8 footers in there too. And I'm like, yeah, and I also made 3 20 footers. Like, I can't say I could have shot lower because I missed 3 coin flips. Again, back to the 65, I hit 3 95-yard sand wedges because I'm trying to force a sandwich 95 yards that I'm trying to kill a sandwich from 95 yards and I just flare it 30 feet short right, literally 3 times. Like those I could say, like, man, if I just taken the 50 and hit the proper shot, I at least probably have a couple of looks. I'm not going to say I would have had made birdies, but then also I had a 3-putt from 50 feet. So that's like, I could have shot, like, again, I could have shot quite a few shots lower, but also I shot well beyond my expectation on the day. And I didn't do any one of those Tiger Five mistakes. I mean, a 3-putt from 50 feet, I'm not that worried about. Again, it's just hard, man. The game's just hard.
Talking about strokes gained not being perfect, that kind of reminds me of what Roberto Castro was saying. Daniel, can you kind of summarize what his argument was? I can't do it off the top of my head.
I'm not going to lie, Coop. I cannot remember specifically what Roberto's argument was. I'd have to go back and listen to the episode again, but
well, let me finish off it because I forgot what my point was with the Tiger Five. Those Tiger Five mistakes get lost in strokes gained. I mean, again, when you finish around, you think you should have shot lower. It should be one of those five, but those little pedantic mistakes are like a 0.02 or something, if even that, in any one of the given categories. Now, again, if you are consistently doing one of them, like the three putting specifically, or the blown easy saves, then yes, your around the green is probably going to be miserable compared to what it should be. But like the occasional drive, like Rory, the occasional drive, he's trying to cut and hits it in the water. I mean, out of, you know, how many hundreds of drives that are in the data, like it kind of gets lost that was more of a mental mistake than a driving mistake. Same thing with just the pedantic bogey from inside, you know, 150, just kind of gets lost in that data. Whereas if you're really focusing on those 5 mistakes, again, I try to tell players after your round of golf, you know, meditate for lack of a better way of saying it, just sit down and take 10 minutes and think through your Tiger 5 mistakes. And is there anything structurally, like decision wise, I could have done different on those? Back when I was playing professionally in my 20s, I used to think like we would just go to the Outback every night and talk about all the stupid stuff we did. And I hope that most of it was Tiger 5 type mistakes. And then I think that I thought I just need to get physically better for those mistakes to go away, as opposed to, is there something strategically or mentally I can do to stop making this one random bogey from 110 every other day, which is just wasting a half a shot. And again, it's mind-boggling how many bogeys inside of 150 yards players on the PGA Tour make. I mean, it's just, even Scottie Scheffler, if you look at the difference in how many strokes he gained on the field, I mean, he averaged 4.88 birdies this year. That's an insane number. But which is like, I think it was like 1.1 better than the tour average. But if he was gaining 2.4 overall and only 1.1 of it was from birdies, that means 1.3 of it was from making fewer bogeys than everyone else. Like he still is better at bogey avoidance than he is at making birdies as far as separating himself from the field. And like, again, that's the best player by a mile in the world right now. And that's just, again, that's how I do believe I shot 75-75 at the U.S. Open. I think I made two birdies. It was a pretty pathetic birdie performance. I just don't make silly, careless bogeys for the most part.
That seems like the best way to do it. I think last question before we wrap up. We didn't talk about it earlier, but, you know, I've heard what I would call alternate theories on, you know, and I'm sure you've heard them too, about curving the ball, especially with irons, how it can be advantageous, like going into greens only in specific circumstances, being the PGA Tour, tucked pin, hard greens, et cetera. If you were going to, and I've heard some data as well, we've had someone on talking about that. If you were going to try to test, like take that theory versus other theories, what do you think the best way, not like which one is right, what do you think the best way to test those against each other is?
There's really not a way to test them because, and this is where every study from other genres where they talk about block versus random practice, like they just poorly apply them to golf. And I don't believe, like I can't even prove that my side of this fence is correct. Like for me to say I drive the ball better by shaping it one direction, I would then, to do the counterfactual, I would need to go practice for 3 years shaping it both ways and see if I'm any better. Like, I'm not going to do that. I drive it really well as is. I can tell you that from working with every single player on the PGA Tour, they drive it better working the driver one direction as is. But start off what you said there initially.
With the theory that from other people?
Yeah.
As to curving it? So the theory is,
I know what I was going to say. I got it. So let's pretend a pin is on the back left and the greens are firm. And if the ball is going to run out, like we're talking at least as 8 or 7 iron or more, that hole is going to play with a significantly over par scoring average. I don't need to. So yeah, maybe it might be cool to get it back there, like shaping back towards the hole in order to get a better look at birdie. But again, if you to have a realistic chance at birdie, I need to get it inside of 15 feet. Nothing is setting up well on this hole for me as a fader to make birdie. But what I can do pretty easily is hit a 6 or 7 iron, starting at the flag, cutting towards the middle of the green, and probably two putting and walking off the green with par. Again, like I said earlier, the difference in a 30 footer and a 60 footer is basically the difference in a 4 footer and a 6 footer. Like in the Instagram post that I'm talking about from last week, it's worth going and looking at. It's Decade_Golf. The difference in a 3 foot make rate, which is, or strokes to hole out, is 1. The difference in an 8 foot strokes to hole out is 1.5. So it takes you 5 feet to lose your first half shot of expectation. Where they average 2 putts to hole out is 32 feet. So the difference in a 3 footer and an 8 footer is the exact same difference as an 8 footer and a 32 footer. You lose your first half shot of value in 5 feet. It takes 24 more feet to lose your next half shot of value. This is why Tiger was correct when he said, "I was the best player in the world because I was the best lag putter in the world." Also in that he's the best iron player in the world because he can say like, man, if I'm in a bad spot, I can just kind of hit towards the middle of the green and two put it and move on until the setup is better for me. This is like, in poker, you know, not to make too many poker analogies, but like 7-8 suited when you're first to act, it's not a great hand. 7-8 suited on the button or the cutoff, I've got more information. I'm going to get more information after the flop. That's a completely playable hand depending on how many people are already in the pot because I've got more information. It's a better setup. So for me, and I still wouldn't even say like I'm trying to cut a 6-iron close to a right pin on firm greens, but there's a better chance of it accidentally rolling out close. I'm still going to play the same shot. I'm still going to do everything else the same. But yeah, this has probably got a little bit better scoring average for me. I can't remember who it was, Kenny Perry or somebody that either draws it or fit. Let's just pretend draws it for some reason. What do you do when the pin's on the right? I make par. What do you do when the pin's on the left? I've got a chance at birdie. Like that's so subtle and so brilliant. It's unbelievable. So this last way I'll try to tie this point up. There's a par three, number 15 at Innisbrook that I've got this video on in the Decade app. This one day on the PGA Tour, its scoring average was 3.22. It's 195 yards with a massive green. If they can, these guys can just take a six iron and hit it on the green, accidentally some are going to be close and they're going to make a few birdies, and accidentally some are going to be on the other side of the green and they're going to three putt for par. But if, or three putt for bogey. But if I just put the pin on anywhere on the green and then I just randomly scatter balls all around the green, they should average roughly two putts to hole out. Now, if I can just hit a 28 yard wide green, I'm probably going to average three to hole out. Obviously, you're not going to hit it every time, but it's just not that hard to average a little bit over par on this hole. The average winner on the PGA Tour every single week is 12 to 14 shots clear of the field average in a full field event. These small fields are making it a little bit dumber, but they're 12 to 14 shots clear of the field average. If I take this 195-yard par 3 and kind of hit the green and pretty much two-putt it, I'm gaining 0.2 shots against the field. If I do that 72 times, so if we played just this one hole 72 times, I'd be gaining almost 16 shots against the field. The equivalent golf of parring this hole every single time is literally winning every one of your starts on tour. And so you have to start thinking in fractional strokes gain. To tie it back to your question, if the pin's on the back left and I'm playing a fade, if I just hit the green and two-putt it, I'm still gaining against the expectation. I don't care if the winning score is 30 under. I make par here. I'm getting closer to winning the tournament. When Cameron Smith won the tournament champions 5 years ago, whatever it was, he shot 34 under and he was 14 shots clear of the field average. When Zach Johnson won the Masters, he was one over and he was 14 shots clear of the field average. Again, back to the idea of, like, I don't care what the score is. Like, we need to get 12 to 14 shots clear of the field average. And this is why getting locked into what par is and all this other stuff, like, you just have no idea what the winning score is going to be. So trying to become immune to it is the way to play your most emotionless golf, which I believe is the optimal way to play.
Well, that's perfect. We appreciate you joining us. Remind everyone where they can find Decade, where they can find you on social media, all that fun stuff.
At this point, we've finally grown up as a company. We've got decade.golf. Just go there. You can see testimonials from guys like Zalatoris and Stuart Sink and Maverick McNealy and all these other players. There's links to buy the app through there. Instagram. Luckily, I punted Twitter, thank God, because it's a cesspool. Instagram, I've got decade_golf, and I do try to post a lot of pretty relevant content there. Again, there's a lot more in the Decade app that obviously I hold back for for members, but I do believe that it's a great learning environment just to go ahead and figure out the general basics of what it is I teach.
Perfect. Be sure to follow Scott. Check out Decade. If you're listening to us on Spotify, Apple Podcast, or YouTube, please like and subscribe. And if you're listening to us or trying to find us on social media, you can find us on Instagram at @TheTournamentCode and on Twitter/X Tournament Code. As always, we appreciate you joining us and look forward to diving in deeper to what it takes to play elite tournament golf.